7, verse 31.
And
it says, behold, the righteous man shall be paid on earth, and how much more so the wicked and the sinner.
Who is he speaking to? Okay. Is he speaking to the righteous?
He knows the source of life.
So who are they telling this to, that the source of life is in the mouth of the righteous?
And we will discuss both interpretations.
The beginner that wouldn't know this.
When it says that the righteous will be paid on this earth, Rashi holds that he'll be paid for his sins on this earth.
And the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, and you shouldn't go to them.
And the how much more so the wicked Rashi says in during his life or after death.
What do we mean by the source of life altogether?
How much more so the wicked in this life or in the world
is
to come?
That there are certain basic principles.
In this life or in death.
Or in
his death. Okay?
Whether they know it or not.
The Ibn Ezra says that the righteous will be paid on this earth, his reward will be on this earth.
So therefore you have a certain philosophy of life that really
and how much more so, in other words, he'll be paid for his deeds. How much more so will the wicked be paid for their evil deeds? In other words, on this earth.
That's your philosophy of life.
Okay.
I'm not saying that stealing is wrong.
In other words, he learns that the righteous will be paid good and the wicked will be paid evil.
Rashi's
approach first.
That is the source of life. The source of life is
what is the world to come
that you're guided by.
And what do we know about it?
Okay,
Maimonides says that we could know about the world to come,
that they don't even realize,
that means after death,
you have to start checking out to see what
as a blind person, no sight, or a person that's deaf, no sound. Now we're talking about a person that's blind from birth or deaf from birth.
Okay.
Now the question is, what can a blind person
know
about color?
I agree, but I'm just, I agree with that.
If he never saw color, what can he know about color?
But I'm just trying to show you that it's
impossible to know color if you've never seen it. You can't explain color.
Okay.
You can't explain color. You can't learn it from somebody else. You've never seen it.
The source of that
philosophy, if you've never seen it, so then how could you know it?
Now the question is, if it's not based on reality,
there is that a blind man can never experience color
because
he can't experience it. So he can't,
what people do is
like
that
he can't see it, so he can't experience it.
Emotions,
but however, he could know the causes
and desires
of color.
Psychological motives,
let's say we teach him about the science of color, how color comes about, so he can know the causes, what brings about color, but however, he cannot know, he cannot experience it.
But the verbal philosophy, what they actually
Ronnie says, is the same thing with the world to come.
About,
we cannot experience
life after death. Because the reason is that they've
that
made
we cannot,
an
since
emotion
we can't experience
into a philosophy.
We could know it exactly like a blind man.
Philosophy of
night
makes right.
And therefore, what we can know are the causes of the world to come.
They want to win.
So many times when we talk about the world to come, what we're talking about are the causes of the world to come. Or we can talk about what we don't have in the world to come. Like, for instance, we won't have physical experiences. We won't have emotional experiences. All these things which we experience, we won't have in the world to come. This will cause you, in other words, to have the world to come. So therefore, the interpretation of this verse is somehow going to fit into the how you get there. Now the question is what gets a person to the world to come? What causes a person to get to the world to come?
There are two things. Everybody has a philosophy, and all
his
these philosophers
knowledge,
contradict each other.
His ideas,
you know, some people hold that love, that's the whole
concept,
thing, other people hold that might not
and,
be right, and other people
hold how much is emotion
and you know which one is right.
Are
everybody
in line.
Some of
those
them have
ideas.
To be wrong, and maybe they're all wrong. Maybe we don't have
now,
the
by
right
ideas,
philosophy.
The first possibility by ideas, I mean that, see, let's say a person has an idea, but he doesn't live by it. That's not what we mean by an idea. An idea has to be real to him that he lives by. Okay? So therefore, a person has knowledge and he sees the truth, so he lives by those ideas. Then the second thing, but sometimes, is even though you live by those ideas, sometimes your emotions are not in line. The second part of your development is that your emotions come in line with these ideas.
All kinds of questions.
One happens, now, let's say, for instance, a tzaddik does, a righteous person does an incorrect act. Okay. Now, at some point, he's going
to
pay the consequences.
Okay.
Now, when he pays the consequences, how does he relate to those consequences? Even if he doesn't have consequences from his actions, let's say, for instance, something in the physical world goes wrong, and he didn't cause it, and he feels confident about this catastrophe, he feels confident about something that happened to him, right? Now that shows, when he has a conflict, that shows that somehow his emotions are not in line with reality. You see, that points to him that his emotions are not in line with reality, and therefore he realizes that he has to start dealing with his emotions. You see, and that there's two types of conflicts. There's a conflict between two parts of the emotions. In other words, let's say, for instance, one part wants to do something, and the other part says you should feel guilty about it. I mean, it doesn't really say, but you just experience guilt. So therefore, that's one type of conflict. It's a conflict from within. There's another conflict where the physical world doesn't fit in with my emotions, so I have a conflict with the physical world.
People, right? Well, then
they either one of these conflicts show that I'm not guided by my mind. In other words, these conflicts, I mean, I might be guided by my mind, but these conflicts show that my emotions are not in line with the ideas of my mind.
So they
therefore,
that
the
tzaddik,
the righteous person, realizes that at that point that he has to start dealing with his emotions. A problem comes to a righteous person, so he starts correcting these emotions, and when he does that, so then of course he's getting closer to what is a different level in the world to come. That's what gets you to the world to come. So therefore, that's, in other words, we're saying the causes to get you in the world to come are your ideas and your emotions. Now, once you have the true ideas, and you see that your emotions are not in line with these ideas, so then you start correcting your emotions. Either you did an incorrect act without realizing it because the emotion affected you, so then you have to correct the emotion and the act. Sometimes you just see that it's just the emotion, so therefore you have to be careful that that emotion shouldn't affect you, so you start dealing with that emotion. Is that heaven on earth or in the world to come, some other place? Okay? Right? Because we seem to be talking only about this world. Right? The thing is that we have something within us that is totally not physical. Okay? There is a part of us which is totally not physical. You could call it spiritual, but I know the word spiritual has many different connotations. That's why I'd rather say it has nothing to do with anything you know. It's totally not physical, it's not emotional, it's none of those things. So therefore, I mean, that is what we call spiritual. Spiritual is really non-physical. Okay? We don't know, okay? Now, the thing is that there is a part of us that is totally not physical. That part of us is what remains after we die.
Why are you getting
this
angry?
This non-physical thing.
You see?
Now this non-physical thing, how can you experience it? Because you can only experience physical things, emotional things, you see?
Okay.
But you can't experience...
You can't experience a non-physical thing.
That's an impossibility.
But the thing is,
so therefore, that is what remains after you die. Now, the question is how do we affect this part of us? How do we get this part affected? Now, when we get our physical being in line with concepts and ideas, that is what we really call soul food. Okay? In other words, that's what really benefits the soul. And that's how the soul develops. And as the soul develops, that gives you a portion in the world to come.
From false philosophy, should go to the righteous.
Getting your life in line with ideas, that means your actions and your emotions are in line with these ideas.
The incorrect philosophy.
Or the ideas of Torah.
Then you can listen to these.
What causes the soul to develop
to
reach the world to come.
But analyze it. But before your mind is ready to analyze, you should be very, very careful. You should at least
consequences. Because sometimes you see a person righteous person could live a hard and difficult life. The thing is that whenever something wrong comes in your life,
and you can
there are,
yourself,
according to Maimonides, there are three causes. There is yourself, other people, and the laws of nature. Now he says the most harm that a person does is by himself. He causes his own harm. Then the next is through from other people, and the least that ever occurs is from the laws of nature.
What is the subject of the verse? Okay.
Now, whenever we have a trouble in the physical world, we have to analyze where it comes from. If it has nothing to do with me at all, that I didn't do anything wrong, then I just have to deal with the problem and I don't have to correct my life because I didn't do anything wrong. But if investigation, I see that I'm the cause of this problem, so then I have to deal with it. Like, let's say, for instance, somebody insults me. Right? Now, I could just say, well, that guy is a vicious guy and he insulted me. That's it. Or I could say, did I say anything? Or did I do anything that brought out this anger?
See?
If I did, so then I would then I have to correct it. In other words, it's not always obvious, but sometimes very subtle. You see? But however, the fact is that needs an investigation, whether you're the cause or whether it's outside factors.
On their feelings, how they feel about life, then they
work the righteous. Okay, now what about the wicked? Now the verse says how much more so the wicked. Now why is it more so by the wicked? Because, I mean, a person faces consequences, and here it's saying that it's greater for the wicked. So the question is, why is it more, the consequences will be more for the wicked than for the, and by the way, the consequences also will be greater for the wicked. The question is, why?
So they build a whole philosophy out of it to make it...
A person does an evil act and he's successful.
Part of life is the correct
way. Okay, let's say, for instance, let's say a child gets into trouble and he gets away with it.
What happens is that
he feels secure in this lie. He feels that the lie made him successful.
See, the source of life
So therefore, when he sees that the lawyer made him successful, so he continues lawying to get out of trouble. Now, the more you do an act, the more it becomes second nature to you until it becomes a natural thing to lie. And then he becomes a, a liar. Right by nature. Now, as he becomes a liar by nature, he's not so careful where he lies, and it's just the most natural thing, and sooner or later, he will get caught, and he will pay the consequences. You see?
Right.
In other words, when you live an irrational life, you're living out of line with reality. Now, at some point, that reality is going to affect you. Now, the more you do it, so like Cal says, it becomes quantitatively more you start doing it, and you qualitatively, you start, in other words, it becomes part of you, your nature, that this is what you always do to get out of trouble, is that you lie. And therefore, sooner or later, you will definitely, that's why it's definitely pay the consequences. See, the righteous person is moving in the opposite direction.
Okay.
So the quantity and quality of the emotions are getting less, which means that the incorrect actions are less. So therefore, the odds of him getting the consequences become less. While the evil person, the more he does, the higher the probability of his getting caught.
Okay?
Many times when we see an evil person that at the beginning that he is successful, let's take that child that lies, other kids in the class see that he lied and that he got away with it. So they say, oh, lying is the way to get away, to get out of trouble, so they start thinking in terms of lying. That is where we run into trouble when we're jealous of the wicked person's success. The wicked person's success is only short-lived, because he will, he's bound to get caught, right in this world, not the world to come, but in this world, he will pay the consequences.
Every lifestyle is based on...
Is that sometimes people are going to ask, is that they see sometimes people that they're wicked, and they are successful, and sometimes they even... succeed till the very end of their life. Okay? Now you have to understand there are two types of people that we look at as wicked. Okay? There is one wickedness that he puts his own life into that area. Like for instance, a person that seeks power, like Hitler or Haman. Haman. You see, these people, their whole life was dedicated to power. It was a philosophy of power, and they lived by that philosophy. Or, for instance, money. Their whole life was making money. Nothing else mattered. They put all their energy into one area. That is that they live really by a certain philosophy of life, and they're guided by that philosophy. However, most of the people in the world do not fit into this type of wickedness. Most of the people we call mediocrity. What it is that they put, they have a lot of different emotions in different areas. In other words, they'll work all those that they make money, but they won't kill themselves to make money. And they watch a little TV, they'll get involved in sports, and then there's a certain amount to the family, and all these different, they're involved in many, many different things. The righteous and the wicked that we talk about mostly in Torah basically deals with where two people, the two opposites, but what they have in common, the righteous and the wicked, is that they put all their energy into what they're doing. It becomes a philosophy of life, and that is that's the only way of living your life. And it's not divided into different components, which is, that's why most people are mediocrity, because they don't put their energy, their total energy, into any one area. Well, now, once you put all your energy into one area, what happens is that suddenly Nachmanides says that that happens in most cases. Okay, it's very rare that this world will make it through. Every once in a while, you will find the wicked that pull through. In fact, that is where the question is, where how come, in other words, how is it possible in God's world that a wicked person could be successful? That is the only wicked person that the question is. It's a rarity. See, when you see, when most people see the wicked being successful, they're really successful at the beginning, but they don't stop to see the consequences. Like, for instance, today they say that people lost weight, so people get jealous of people lost weight. But now they're saying, yeah, but that's no real success. You haven't seen if they can keep it off. The same thing with the wicked. Most wicked, because they put all their energy into one area of one emotion, really. And the whole philosophy of life is guided by that emotion. There's going to be a place where they break. Like they put all their eggs in one basket, and at one point it's going to all break. Say,
in other words, like
the mediocrity, they are also not happy because they really they're not happy because they're really not successful in anything. They make money, but they look at the real rich and the rich, and they're jealous of them. And they might have a little desire for fame, and they look at they're jealous of them, so they're really not happy. But however, that total breakdown many times will not happen to mediocrity in the physical world. You see what I mean? So the thing, but happiness, the wicked and mediocrity will never happen. See, happiness is no compliment. Which means a person that's constantly driven in a certain area, that means he's in conflict. That they can never have. Either mediocrity or totally wicked. That they can never have happiness. But however, the wicked, very rare, can have a certain type of success. Okay? Within the physical world, not if God intervenes. If God intervenes, of course, it breaks down. But however, the wicked will most of the time be, it will fail, and rarely will they be successful. You look at the results. In other words, don't look at the beginning of their lives, but you have to look at the wicked in the end of their life. You'll see that that's not the life to be jealous of.
There's
nothing to be jealous of what they have.
They identify with them.
That to clarify is that the wicked will break down totally. They'll have they'll really be destroyed totally. Like if you look at Hitler, towards the end he was sending out troops that didn't exist. His mind was going, and he lost everything. You see, while mediocrity many times will live in their mediocre world throughout, and they don't reach that reality that breaks them, even though many times they do. But I can't say the quantity over there. Because many times there, a person could live out his life the way, his mediocre life. Because he's not really bucking reality to that extent. So therefore, it is more often that he, it's really based, like for instance, if you live in a society that's more successful, so why would these people be successful? If you live in a society where society's breaking down, so most of these people will be failing. You see what I mean? It depends on very much outside factors. While the wicked guides his life from within, he's driven from within, and he guides his life from within. Mediocrity guides life from society and the world around, and they really don't make any real decisions in life. They're just guided by outside
energy. The love that we were talking about in the verse is...
What is the subject of this verse?
Everybody
was that the subject of this verse is the consequences. But the problem with that is it's too universal, because really the whole book of Proverbs deals with consequences. So I think that we have to be a little more precise over here in this verse.
And so therefore you have a love of people.
He says an interesting statement. He says, why is the wicked so secure at the moment that they are successful? Don't they see the righteous that they have to pay for their sins that they do while they're still on this earth, I think the subject of what we're talking about here is how you view the righteous, an outside person, viewing the righteous and the wicked. See, many times we view the righteous when he starts out, and he's really not that successful, especially at the beginning. First of all, he's putting most of his energy into study. And like, for instance, Jacob, our sages say that in figuring out his life, there are 14 years missing. And they say, where's that 14 years? They say the 14 years are missing is from when he left, when he ran away from Esau, and before he came to Laban. Those are 14 years, and they say, what did he do? During those 14 years, he spent in studying. So he's a very poor person. He was just sitting and studying, and he didn't have any money. I mean, he lived very poorly because he had to stay away from Esau. So he stayed away from home, so he didn't have any money, so he's very poor. In fact, when he came to Laban, he was a poor person. That's why he had to work. He had to start from scratch. Well, a person that starts out in the world evil, he has success right away. So many times, what happens is we look at the immediate. That's what you wanted to say, Bill. That they just look at the immediate, and you see that the righteous are a failure, and you see the wicked are successful. So therefore, that draws you to the wicked. That draws you to the wicked way of life. But however, a person that pulls back and says, one minute, let me think about this, let me see the result of all this, let me see 20 years later, let me see if, like, for instance, in dieting, if they kept their weight off, you see, let me look 3 years later, that people can't keep in mind. That's already only in the mind, it's not a experience. People live by what they experience at the moment. You see, their immediate feelings, their immediate experience. But however, the righteous stop to think about the consequences. They think about the consequences. So the thing is that there's two ways of viewing the righteous and the wicked. You see, one way is based on the immediate. Then the wicked come out better than the righteous. But if you look at the results in their life, the end year, you know what I mean? The latter half of their life, then you'll see that the righteous are more successful. Also, the righteous and their success do not make it public. One is because they don't have a need to, and the second thing is that they don't want to bring out the jealousies of others, because jealousy will cause others to try and destroy them. So therefore, even their successes, they try to minimize and not to try to make it that people can see it. You understand that they try to make it not observable. So, for two reasons. One is because they don't care. That's not their interest. And secondly, they protect themselves from other people that way. So therefore, sometimes even the successes are not noticeable. And therefore, you have to really be like a scientist to observe and to think about it. So the thing is, I think the subject of the verse is that there are two ways of observing the wicked and the righteous. You see? There's two ways of observing. One is, in other words, when you observe the right, in other words, there's two ways of observing the wicked and the righteous. You see, there's two ways of observing people. One is to observe them based on the immediate, and one is to observe on the overall lifestyle and the total picture. Then there's two different views there.
human beings' emotions.
I have to retract from yesterday's final definition. Okay? The reason is because Rashi seems to say, see, the definition includes, like, where the tzaddik is successful and not successful. Rashi is only dealing with the tzaddik where he is tzaddik or the righteous, where he is, where he pays back for his, where he pays consequences for his mistakes, for his wrong acts. Right? So therefore, the definition has to be based on only the negative part. What Rashi is saying is that there are two levels. There are two levels of consequences. Okay? And he's saying that when you view the tzaddik and you see that he gets... what is the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha? The rasha is the wicked, right? So the tzaddik is the person that is moving away from making mistakes, right? The rasha, as he gets more involved in his act, so he keeps getting more, he keeps operating more based on the emotional. In other words, the tzaddik is moving to having more security of the mind and moving away from the emotional, while the rasha is moving more towards the emotional and feeling security and emotional away from the mind, right? So therefore, the tzaddik is moving towards less mistakes, right? Because that's the emotions which make you cause you to make mistakes, right? And while the rasha is moving towards more mistakes, and also there's another thing is that the rasha, besides doing more mistakes, he has more security in it, so he doesn't protect himself from it. Before, he might watch himself or guard himself from, like, getting... Let's say, for instance, he does something wrong in society, so he might watch himself from getting caught. But as he gets more security, he doesn't even watch that because he feels the security that I could do it. So, okay? All right. Now, the thing is that when people look at the... Now, the question is, so, of course, what Rashi is saying is obviously right. What is the problem? Why can't everybody see it? You see? What I think is that, you see, when people look at the tzaddik, people have an emotional view of a righteous person, and they see him as a perfect person. Now, when they see him suffer, the thing is, the emotions really want is the type of success that the wicked have. Every human being wants that. They want money, they want fame. Now, when they see weaknesses in the tzaddik, and they see certain consequences of the tzaddik, so then they start saying, well, it's not worth it, you see? The emotion really wants the life of the rasha, you see? So therefore, but however they're pulled, they see, well, maybe I should be a tzaddik, because then I get the world to come, I'll get the good world, God will pay me, God will relate to me. When they see the tzaddik doesn't have the, that he pays for the consequences, so they say, now why should I live the life of the righteous? Why should I give up the physical world? Right, all the pleasures of the physical world, and live the life of the righteous, and still get consequences. I'm better off living the life of the wicked. You see, that is the emotional argument. So Rashi says, no, just the contrary. If you see that the righteous get consequences, then you should say, how much more so will I get the consequences because I'm making these foolish mistakes. In other words, if you look at life from the emotional point of view, how emotions look at life, so they say, look, really the great pleasurable life and the best life is the life of the wicked. Now, why? Of course, they don't think this way consciously, but that's what happens in the emotions. That is the best life. In fact, where many times we see people have success, we're jealous of them. Why are we jealous? Because we really think that's the best life, you see? And then we look at the righteous and we say, well, I'll live the life of the righteous, so I shouldn't have so I shouldn't have any troubles in this world. But then if I see the righteous having problems, so I say, why should I live the life of the righteous? So Rashi is saying this verse is coming to counteract that emotion. And he's saying, if you see that the righteous, logically, if you see that the righteous have a consequence, how much more so should the wicked have a consequence? You see? The wicked should definitely have a consequence. So don't follow your emotions, because the emotions are making a terrible mistake. If you live the life of the wicked, you're not going to have a good life. It's true, the tzaddik does have consequences, but the consequences of the rasha is much, much greater and much worse than the consequences of the tzaddik. Okay? That is what Rashi is saying, that there's two levels of consequences, right? Therefore, you should be careful that just because the tzaddik gets consequences, don't turn away from him, because the thing is that you should still take his consequences over the consequences of the wicked. I'd just like to comment on the last idea that if you really understand this verse, it becomes part of you, then you wouldn't have any jealousy for anybody else's success. Let's put it this way, at least you won't have jealousy for any other type of success. In other words, at least you could redirect your jealousy towards the life of the tzaddik and get your emotions to help you work on Torah. Because once you see this, how could you be jealous of these people? They're going to have terrible consequences. The jealousy of the tzaddik is not the highest level of a human being, but it's a good help to help you operate, to get your emotions to help you operate in the correct direction until you get rid of jealousy completely. That's a very high level. So we assume that a person that has a lot of physical things are wicked. The answer is no. We had many righteous people that were unbelievably wealthy, and they were they say Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi had horses that at feeding time you could hear them miles away. You know what I mean? There were so many. I mean, we had many people that were wealthy. We don't know wealth is evil. What we hold is that people think that the wicked, let's say, for instance, Tzaddik at the beginning, when he first starts out, he's going to sit and learn, and he's not going to go towards wealth. He might become wealthy later, but first he's going to put, like we one time mentioned, that Jacob, before he went to Laban, our sages say that he studied for 14 years, and he didn't have any money. So the thing is, and then he became wealthy later. You see, in other words, at the beginning, it's rougher to go the righteous way. So therefore, when you first view the two worlds and your desire is to go the way of the wicked, you say, well, I see the righteous are poor, and they get their consequences. So why bother? You see? That's what they do. It's really an emotion to really... the immediate emotion what sees the effects. You see what I mean? The immediate effects, that they can get it faster. They can get their wealth very quick, and they can get their fame or their success, they can get very quick. We're doing chapter 12, verse 1. And it says, he who loves Musar loves knowledge. He who hates Tochacha is an animal. The word Musar and the word Tochacha, the Hebrew words, according to the Meiri, means perfection of human traits. Okay? Those two, they're both synonyms, Musa and Tochacha, meaning the perfection of human traits. And the word, and knowledge is perfection of the mind. Okay? So, you must love perfection of human traits to love knowledge, and a person that hates it, He's an animal. The question is what brings you to love the perfection of the human traits? Okay, in other words, a Musar. What brings you to love Musar? Somebody who hates human traits, the perfection of human traits, why is he considered an animal? Can a person have perfection of knowledge without the perfection of human traits? How are we using the word love? What do we mean by an animal? Okay? And is in other words, in all opposites, some opposites have a means and some opposites don't. Is there a means between love and hate of human traits? Okay, is there a means or not? For instance, hot and cold has a means warm. Motion and non-motion does not have any means. Does that mean a middle ground? Yeah. Second question that I'd like to ask is that according to the Ibn Ezra changes the verse around. And he says, as he who loves knowledge will love Musar. So he changes the verse. By what right does he change the verse, and why does he do it? The possibility of what an animal is, and that is a person that's guided by their instincts and not by their intellect. But before we could define what an animal is, we have to know what the verse is talking about. In other words, is the verse talking about, what is knowledge, perfection of knowledge? Let's say, for instance, a lot of people have knowledge. What does he mean that, I'll ask another question. Let's ask another question. We see a lot of intelligent people that have a lot of knowledge, and yet they're not very nice. They don't have any perfection of their traits. You see? Okay? So, and also, by the way, we have to ask another question while we're going along. What is perfection of your traits? In other words, human nature. What is, how would you define when it's out of sync, and how would you define when it's in sync? According to the Meiri, he says that the perfection, imperfection, is when you have an extreme. Okay, like for instance, let's say stingy and spendthrift. Stingy is I keep spending money despite the fact that sometimes I should spend. Like let's say, for instance, I can't spend money on a doctor because I can't use my money. Or I can't use my money to enjoy it, whichever way. While a spendthrift doesn't know how to save and to protect himself from the future. So he says that a incorrect human trait is extreme, while the healthy emotion is where it's down the center, where you're not drawn to one side or the other. Okay? In other words, you have both. You want to spend money and you want to save money, and of course you're so. Therefore, that's why it's in between. Okay, that's what the Miri says that's what the imperfection of human traits and the perfection of human traits are. The purpose of Musa and Telchacha is to perfect it when it's incorrect, when it's not working correctly. The purpose of Musan Telchacha is to help you straighten it out. What guideline can a person tell in his own life when he's an extreme? You can tell when you study reality and you find out what reality says, and then you can't carry it out. You see? You can't carry it out. The extreme forces you in the other way. You keep having conflicts. Let's say, for instance, you're stingy, and you know you spend money on a doctor, and you just can't do it. Then you know you're in trouble. We see from this point an imperfect, where you lack Musa, where you don't have Musa, where you don't have this perfect trait. So the thing is, it causes you to act incorrectly. Okay? even though you have the true idea, it causes you to act incorrectly. Okay? Well, we've said so far that the imperfection of human traits means that it is an extreme part of you that forces you to act on the incorrect way, even though when you think about it, you might see the correct way. Also, what it does is it doesn't allow you to see the correct way. It doesn't allow you to see the correct way, and sometimes you think incorrectly because of this. You say, in other words, like this. When a person saves money, he holds that that's the correct thing. He'll defend his saving of money rationally. He'll show you that it's the correct thing, even though you see that it's absolutely ridiculous. Or the people that do things in a moment of passion, you'll see that later they know that it was incorrect, but at that time they did the act, they actually saw that the idea was 100% correct. There was no doubt in their mind that it was correct. Then later, when the emotion passes, that's when they say, no, it was wrong, that was wrong. That emotions affect the way you think. So therefore, if you do not perfect your human traits, then what's going to happen in areas like, for instance, God, and for instance, in relationship to others, and all the they live like what we would say an animal, you see. So therefore, the way to bring about having true knowledge, real knowledge, knowledge about life itself, about your very existence and your relationship to truth and reality, it's only possible to have that only after you have perfected your human traits. Look around, you'll see people in different areas that deal with human traits, you know what I mean, like sociology, psychology, people that run governments, you see they make terrible errors. Why? Because they interpret those areas according to their incorrect view. Because they have an emotion in a certain area, so they don't see how to analyze it. It forces them to look at it in an incorrect way. When a person has an extreme emotion, before he could gain knowledge, he must lower that extreme, and so that his emotions are evenly keeled. You see, in other words, you're constantly working on yourself to straighten out yourself, to make yourself evenly keeled, you see? And then you can think straight. Then you'll be able to think straight. But as long as you're not evenly keeled, then you can't think straight. By the perfection of knowledge here, what he's saying is that the knowledge is real to you, where you make decisions and affect your personal life. But a person that just has knowledge and ideas that has nothing to do and doesn't affect his life, that we don't consider knowledge. Because that's, in other words, the knowledge is not real to him. Knowledge has to be real to a person. That's real knowledge. That you can only have when you've perfected your human traits. What the verse is really saying, the way of getting knowledge is to have, you must have the perfection of human traits first, or not, you cannot have knowledge. Therefore, a lover of one is a lover of the other. In other words, by love, we mean that he sees, how could he live without this? He's drawn to it. He's drawn to these ideas because he sees that he must have it. Okay? Now the question is, the question was asked before, what is the motive that causes a person to want to have the perfection of human traits? The first possibility that's given is the reason why we should want human perfection is, first of all, the consequences that we'll get, which is true. You will, if you live that way, you will suffer the consequences. That's the whole book of Proverbs, dealing with the consequences of living where your emotions are an extreme. Okay? And could be because a person that's evenly keeled is happier than a person. In other words, if you have an extreme emotion, you're in conflict. So therefore, you're unhappy. Okay? Ibn Ezra says that a person that loves knowledge will love Musa. Okay? What he's saying that the verse is talking about the order in which you must travel. In other words, to gain knowledge, you must have Musa. Okay? But however, the purpose, the motive for studying Musa should be the love of knowledge. Okay? Now, the question is, according to the Ibn Ezra, that is one motive. Because once I love knowledge, I realize that I'm not going to see things clearly, and I won't have the truth, and I'm going to lack the truth, and because I lack the truth, so I'm unhappy. So therefore, I'm going to straighten myself out. So for the purpose of gaining knowledge, okay. All right. That's what the Ibn Ezra is saying. Now the question is, why didn't the Ibn Ezra, if he's talking about motive, why didn't the Ibn Ezra mention the motives that we said, that the consequences and the happiness? What about those? What about those? Why didn't he mention those? Motives? The thing is that the question is like this. See, the Ibn Ezra must hold that the motive of happiness, or the motive of protection against consequences, that motive is not something is weak with that motive. It gets you going, but there must be something weak about it. Namely, either or probably that it can only take you so far and then you won't go further, or it's either you won't study, in other words, you'll study a certain amount of Musa and you'll correct a certain amount of your emotions and then you'll be satisfied, you see, or two, it'll only last a certain amount of time and then it won't be satisfying anymore. Must be one of those two or both somehow. Why the Ibn Ezra says that you must have the motive of knowledge that will drive you on, and it's a better motive. That's the direction that we're moving in. There could be another direction in which the Ibn Ezra is going, not the one that we just mentioned, that there's a weakness with the first motivator, but there could be another direction that he's taking. That is this. Let's say, for instance, you get a person interested in Musar because you say that this will make him happy, or because of the consequences, okay? And he gets involved. Now the question is how does he deal with the how does he correct himself? What method must he do? What must he do? So the thing is what he must do is he has to start thinking. The only cure for imperfect traits are the only way of curing it is through thought. You must think it through, see what's wrong with it, or the different ways, or deal with your emotions. There's different ways of dealing with it, but all of them must be thought. It's all working in the area of thought. Okay? So therefore, what's going to happen is that you're going to see, in other words, if you don't have a love of thinking, then you will not last in this. Because if you don't have a love of thinking, then you're just going to turn away from it. You see? Because how long could it last? I mean, you're forcing yourself to think where it's only, in other words, let's put it this way. You would force yourself to think whenever there's a problem. Whenever there's not a problem, you're not going to bother thinking because you don't enjoy thinking. In other words, if you don't love thinking, then you don't enjoy thinking, you see? So therefore, the only thing that drives you, in other words, if the only thing that drives you is the emotions, in other words, the success or the unhappiness, that's what gets you to think, there are many times that you won't bother thinking about it, you see? And there's many times since you don't love it, you don't enjoy it, so you try not to do it, you see? Because it's not something you enjoy. You only do it when you're forced to do it, you see? So therefore, that's the one way that's really the first direction that we were saying, the first possibility that it will fall by the wayside because you don't enjoy thought. That's one thing, okay? The second thing is that if you get involved in thought, what we're really saying is the first possibility is the correct way. The first direction was correct because if you don't really love thought, then, and since the only cure for the human imperfection, for the human traits, is thought, so if you don't really enjoy thinking, then you'll only use it when you're really in trouble, which is not good enough. In other words, it's like a science. You have to study it and understand how muscle works and understand the whole idea and think it through. And therefore, if you don't really enjoy thought, the only motive is the motive for results, for practical results. It either won't last long or it won't be that good. Because the thing is that you're not going to keep going because you need thought. You must think it through. It's a knowledge. It's a science to think it through. So if you don't really enjoy the science itself, then at a certain point you're going to give it up and you're not going to carry it through. Well, you have made an observation if you're only doing it for practical purposes, then you don't really love Musser. You're only using Musser because of a practical need, because you're unhappy or because you don't want to get the consequences. But however, if you don't love it, so then you really it won't last long. It won't last long because it's only because you don't really love it. So therefore, after a while, it's just going to drop right away. You can't keep that that momentum going just constantly because the thing is it won't be a consistent thing. You'll only deal with it when you have the pain. If you don't have the pain, you're not going to bother. So therefore, if you're not going to bother, you're not going to be consistent in your studies and your analysis of this type of subject, the subject of Musa and the science of Musa. So therefore, because of that, it's not going to last long. It's not really going to work. It's not going to be a thorough analysis. But however, if you love wisdom and you realize that you're thinking incorrectly and it's affecting your thoughts in the areas that are most important to you, namely God and truth and reality and what is real out there, so then you cannot help, then that's going to be constant. You're going to have to love Musa because, first of all, you're going to love the science, and secondly, you're going to have to love the straightening out that you see things clearly. And that's a constant. That's a constant thing. So you're going to actually love Musser. Is when you love truth, that you must love the dealing with your emotions. In other words, straightening out your emotions. You have to understand, when you, whatever a person deals with their emotions, there's a tremendous amount of pain. In other words, you have to face who you really are. It's a tremendous amount of pain. So therefore, also on the first half, whenever the motive is only the consequences or the unhappiness, so the thing is that you're going to have to measure the pain. In other words, what you don't want is the pain, right? What's motivating you is the pain, right? Either the pain in the future or the pain now, right? Now, the thing is that, but then you're going to have to evaluate that pain versus the pain of investigating your emotions, you see, because that's also painful. And since the pain that you're getting now is immediate, and what's pain that's driving you, you might not be able to stand up to the pain. So therefore, you might quit, you see. But however, if your motive is truth, you see, then you love the pain. In other words, like this, so you don't love the pain. A person can't love pain. But what he loves is the same thing. Let's say, for instance, a person has to go into an operation, you see, and it's going to be very painful. You're going to have to cut him, and it's going to be painful. But the thing is, he wants that pain. He's happy with that pain because he will be healthy later, and he'll have a normal life later, you see. So the thing is that that's based on the future, you see. That's based on the future. Because he wants, in other words, like he doesn't want the consequences, so therefore he's willing to take the pain, the immediate pain, okay? But if you don't see the consequences clearly, or you see the pain of the mussar so great that it's not worth it anymore, so then you're going to quit because you're working in a framework of pain. So therefore, you're working in a framework of more pain or less pain, you see? But however, a person that loves truth, you see, for some reason, loves the activity itself, you see? The activity of straightening out all this conflicts and all, in other words, of straightening out the human emotions, he loves that very act, okay? Now, the question is that, in other words, the verse is saying you love that. You love straightening yourself out, you see? Now, the question is that, in other words, that the love of truth will give you the love of actually dealing with your emotions. You see, it's a different thing. That's what the Ibn Ezra is saying, that the... That if you work with the, if you're dealing with the, if you're only dealing measuring pain, so then pain will take you so far. You're going to, well, maybe it's not worth it. But if it's for truth, so then you must undo it because of the truth. You're not a measuring pain. It's one, the desire for truth versus the pain. How could a person love the activity of investigating himself and straightening his deepest emotions, parts of him that he doesn't even want to recognize that exist within him, and face all his traits, I mean, all his extreme traits that he doesn't want to see, he doesn't want to even notice about himself? How could a person actually love it, love that activity? How could a person love that activity? I can understand he desires the activity, and he's happy with the activity, but what makes him love the activity? I think that, but definitely the Ibn Ezra is saying that if you love truth, then you'll love this activity, even though it's a pain. You'll still love it because, what I don't know why, but whatever the reason is that you love it. But however, the other motives, the motive of practicality,
Those motives is just measuring pain against pain. So at a certain point, you're going to quit and give up on the muscle. You know what is why would a person love chastising himself and constantly straightening himself out and thinking about this constantly and love doing it? Is because it'll bring him closer to God. The answer to that is then I don't love the chastisement. Again, it's only as a means for getting close to God. But loving Musa means that I enjoy and I love the activity. But if I do it only because of God, then I don't love the activity. In other words, there must be something in the activity that when you are a thinker, then there's a certain enjoyment in the activity.
Now, we're going to analyze this person today.
So this. That the thing is that if you love knowledge, then what you enjoy in Musa is the investigation of the self. Right? In other words, that's also an investigation. That you must investigate and guide and review. In other words, these ideas, when you straighten yourself out, it's the mind operating. And so the mind, simultaneously that there's a pain in investigating, simultaneously there's another part of you which enjoys thought, which is forcing you to continue the investigation because you enjoy the thought.
That's very good.
That's the way it works. In other words, if you're working on the first part, then it's one pain versus the other. Now, and the pain now is immediate when the investigation is painful, so at a certain point you're going to give up the pain. Okay? But however, if you love knowledge, then the love of knowledge will motivate you to continue going. Even though you do have the pain, it's not the pain that you love, but what you love is the investigation, and you enjoy the idea of straight, in other words, like let's say for instance, like in chess, you enjoy the thought, and then you actually move the piece, there's an activity. And then when you see the activity, and you see how it affects the whole system, so you enjoy how it works, you see? So therefore, the thing is, there's the enjoyment of the thought of Musa, and there's also the enjoyment to see it working within the human being, you see? Of course he doesn't enjoy pain. You can't love pain. That's an impossibility. You could be happy with pain because you know, or you could accept pain because you know the results are good. You see? But however, you can't love pain. You see? But the thing is, what you do love is the investigation and seeing the truth, how it works within you, that it's working within you, like you're straightening out, like a mechanic, when he sees something wrong, it bothers him, he has to straighten it out. Now the same thing, when he sees the incorrect part of him, he enjoys the straightening, in other words, there's two things, there's the thought, he enjoys the thought, and he enjoys straightening out the incorrect thing, because a thinker thinks in terms of a system, and when he sees the system is not working well, he wants to work it out. So therefore he tries to straighten out that which is not working according to the correct system. So therefore he straightens it out, he keeps straightening it out, you see. So that's what he enjoys. He enjoys the thought, and he enjoys straightening out that which is operating incorrectly in the world.
Therefore,
you must say there are two parts. One is the love of knowledge, and then once you love knowledge, you love to see knowledge working correctly in yourself. Knowledge working correctly in the world. By the way, that would also be the cause of justice. When you love the system and you see the truth, how the system works, it bothers you that things are not working correctly. So therefore, you want to straighten out the system to make sure the system works correctly. Okay? That's what Elisha was angry when he met up with Ahab. You see? When he met up with Ahab, he actually got angry. Why? Not because of personal anger, but because he was not operating, the system wasn't operating correctly. It just bothered him. that the system is being destroyed, you see, that bothered him, because the love of the symmetry and the perfection of the system, he has such a love for it that he can't see, he can't tolerate when it's not working correctly. If a person starts out studying Musar because he doesn't want the conflict, so he wants the, he doesn't want the consequences, so that is a good way of starting out. But however, ultimately what he needs is a love of truth to keep him involved in this area.
What we did yesterday was that there are two causes for working on Musa and straightening yourself out. One is because you're in pain, and since you're in pain, so therefore the knowledge, you feel the knowledge will help you out. But we said that will only help you only insofar as you'll have to measure the pain. Okay. And sometimes the pain for the investigation of the self will not be worth it. But however, the better method is because of your love of truth, because if you, the better motive is because of your love of truth, so then you have one part of you, the desire for truth, analyzing another part. So therefore, and therefore you love the analysis and you love to work things out. Okay? Now, I'd just like to retract one point that I made yesterday. Yesterday I said there's two causes for pain. Okay? One is basically because of conflict. Right? And two is that you don't want the consequences. Okay? Now, the thing is, I want to, you have to understand about when you think through an act now, and that you're not going to do it because of the consequences, you have to understand that that is not what we see around us in the world around us. In other words, like this, let's say, for instance, you go to a kid that's going to school. You say, well, why are you going to school? He says, because I have to make a living. I got to learn a profession. You say, now, that kid already, by the time he's in high school, I mean, you're talking about a 13, 14-year-old kid. You mean to tell me he has worked out and thought through, and now he's preparing 8 years in advance? And if he's thinking of going to med school, he's preparing 12 years in advance for making a living? I mean, he can't prepare 2 days in advance. They can't even get their homework in. And he's already preparing in advance. I mean, that's a hard thing, see? So the thing is what's really motivating a person like that is really because he was raised that way, his parents, his society. So if he tries to go against it, since it's a part of him, he's going against his own emotions. And it's immediate pain. It's not really thinking through in the future. That's really, if he tried to give that up, that'd be immediate pain, you see? And our whole society works that way in practically all areas. They only make decisions only because they were raised that way. I'll give you an illustration. Let's say, for instance, around 50, 60 years ago, when you were raised, I mean, a person was raised that they're going to work, and they have simple pleasures. Family, they go out for a ride, for a walk. There were simple pleasures, and that was acceptable, and they realized that that was a good, okay? That was because they were raised that way. The same people, they're no different, raised today, are looking for the loud pleasures. In other words, drugs and speed, driving fast, and races and sports. I mean, unbelievable pleasures, the high pleasures, the fame, the glory. I mean, to an unbelievable extent. What's the difference? You mean we were smarter 50 years ago, and now suddenly we're foolish? The answer is that the people that were born or raised 50 years ago were lucky. They're raised in a society that happened to have been more in line with reality. Today you're raised in a society that's in less in line with reality. So therefore the people today will suffer a lot of consequences, while people years ago didn't suffer as many consequences. But however, it is not really thinking through the consequences. When you live the correct life, basically it's only because of the society you were raised in or the way you were raised by your parents. Is the society years ago, did they think that through? The answer is no. They, for some reason, somehow, there was some reason they were more, I think the reason why they were more in line society, simply practically, they had to make a living. But as the society becomes more wealthy, so and you have more time, so you start looking for other pleasures. But I mean, that reason is not worked out. In other words, you'd have to investigate more. But the fact is that they didn't think it through. Okay? They did not think through the, they just happened to be more in line with reality than the society today. Why that is, I don't know. That's a separate discussion. But the thing is that what you have to, but the thing is, all I'm trying to point out is that these people really are not, just because they're living more in line with reality, doesn't mean that their soul is in line with reality. The question is, who is a person that thinks about the future, that really thinks about the consequences of his life? That's a person that's involved in the world of ideas. He's in other words, if you think a thing through and you do it for the purpose of thought, then that already is a lover of thought. That's what he would consider a lover of thought. In other words, if I study the ideas of Musa, and I live and I start working on Musa because I don't want the consequences, that is, his nature is different. It's a different nature of a person where he thinks things through and make sure that that it's in line with reality, that it already is, and that he's not going to get the consequences, that already is a different person already. He's a person that's guided by ideas, and that person would also be considered that he loves truth, and he would definitely search in the world of Musa and try and chastise himself and straighten himself out until he straightens himself out. He would definitely do that because he's guided by ideas. Person, that's what we mean by perfection of the soul, where he starts working on his very self to start making sure that his emotions and his ideas are in line with truth and reality. That we now have in the verse are these two opposites, with a means. In other words, two opposites, like hot and cold is a means of warm, or is it more like the opposites of motion and non-motion, that there's no means, there's nothing in between the two? I think that there is a means, because the thing is that the means is where pain gets you to investigate this area because of your pain, so you want to investigate to straighten out the conflict that you have. That he doesn't mention in the verse. Okay? Now the question is why doesn't he mention that means in the verse? The answer is that if you only do it for pain, then one of two things are going to happen. Either the pain of the investigation is too strong, and therefore you're going to give it up, so then you'll be like the second if, that you'll hate, that you'll turn away from the Musa. But if you, but if in the investigation you see the knowledge, and you start becoming attached to the knowledge as a result of the investigation, so then you'll become the first if. So therefore, the results are, the ultimate result is going to be either going to be the first half or the second half. But the thing is that sometimes the means could bring you to the life of learning. Because of the pain, you investigate, then you see the ideas, and then you want the life of learning. So therefore it's not mentioned, because the thing is it will not last for a long time.
Ask
the question is that the second half of the verse says he who hates Musar, he becomes he's an animal. Now, he is, let's say a person that doesn't care. You know, he's ignorant. He doesn't know Musa. Well, if he doesn't know Musa, then we can't include him in the pasuk because he doesn't know it, so we don't know how he will react. But to be impervious to Musa, that's the question. Okay? If somebody tries to give you, in other words, if somebody tries to guide you, let's say he advises you, he gives you an idea. If it's based, in other words, if it's based, in other words, there's two things. Let's say, for instance, I say, well, you could do this type of pleasure, that type of pleasure, and I happen to enjoy this type of pleasure. I'll show you why this type of pleasure is greater. Now, if that's not important to your life, unless you're a person that has to always be right, and you know what I mean, then you might find out such a point. Okay. But basically, it's not important, so if you say, if you don't agree, so it's not important, so, you know what I mean, it's not the essence. But if you're talking about something that's very basic to you, like religion, you know what I mean, and who you are and what your nature is, then I don't think you could be impervious to Muslim. I think it's either you're going to see the truth and you have to accept it, or you're going to have to turn away from it. Question is that a person that's
does not exclude what I'm saying.
If a person does something that, in other words, let's say a person does sometimes the truth, but if it's in line with their nature, then that is not Musa. I mean, he might be and he might not be, and he might be able to see the truth and he might not be able to see the truth. The real test comes when you see an idea that not in line with your nature, not in line with your emotions. Can you say, I'm still going to do the correct act and still try and straighten myself out and make sure I do that act? You see, that's the difficulty of Musa. The difficulty of Musa is because when you see truth, you have to sometimes turn away from your basic nature sometimes and your basic desires and strong, powerful emotions, and you have to give that up. That is the difficulty of the life of Musa, and that's why people turn away from it. As was mentioned, that's what we're calling pain. You see that, how difficult it is, and why we use the word pain. It's because there's so few people that can do this. Even when you show them the truth, they have to make a change in their basic lifestyle, the way they look at life, the way they feel about life. Everything has to be changed, guided by ideas. That is not an easy thing. That is what we mean by the pain. The question is, what does it mean by the word animal? Okay? What we have to do is define what a metaphor is. A metaphor is when you use a certain term, but you don't mean the whole term, you only mean one quality of that term. Only one quality.
More like an animal.
Now, say that begin, Rabbi Yosef Kairo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, when he starts Shulchan Aruch, he says a person should wake up in the morning like a lion. Okay? Now, some people wake up in the morning like a lion and they roar. I don't think he had that in mind. Now, the quality of a lion is that he sits around and he just relaxes. But if he has to do something, So he gets up immediately and is right away moving. There is no in-between between inactivity and activity. However, the human being is dependent on what's doing that morning. If he has to go to school or to work, then there's something called stretching or turning over, which is in between waking up and doing an activity. But if you're going to do something exciting, like your own vacation, then from inactivity to activity is one big swoop. Now, a person, every morning when he wakes up and he realizes that he can now serve God, he should be so excited that with one big swoop, he gets right up. He can't turn over because he's wasting time from relating to God. So therefore, that's what he means to wake up like a lion. So the thing is, you notice we're only taking that one quality of a lion. Okay? That is what we mean by a metaphor, when we take one quality. Right? So if we want to analyze the term animal here, what do we have to define what that quality is? Okay. The thing observation was made that the that an animal has instincts, but a human doesn't. A human has instincts and emotions, and the animal doesn't have emotions. That is true. But the thing is, when the animal operates, there's one thing that he has in common with certain type of people, is that he doesn't work with thought. He only works with the instincts. Now, there are certain humans that don't work with thought, so then they work with what they have, what would be their animalistic instincts, namely instincts and emotions. While the animal, since he doesn't have any possibility of thought, and he doesn't have emotions, so he only works with instincts. But the quality that we're looking for is that an animal doesn't make any decisions, conscious decisions, made by an idea. Therefore, this person is not, I mean, he might be a great mathematician, he might be a great physicist, he might be even a great doctor, but however, he is not guided by thought. If he hates us, if he cannot change his life around, if he cannot say, I'm going to do an act contrary to what I desire and love to do because I see the harm in it, if he cannot do that, and he turns away from it, then I say that that person is an animal. According to King Solomon, definitely, that person is an animal, because he's totally not guided by thought, even though he has a lot of ideas, maybe more ideas than we have. But he's still not guided by thought.
The question is,
what is the subject of the verse? Relating to Musa. In other words, the subject is your response to Musa or how you relate to Musa. And there are two ways of relating to it. Either you love it or you hate it. That's it. That is really what the verse is talking about.
But without wisdom, the wealthy man can destroy himself too. And his money won't be a protection for him. First, King Solomon is going against his basic philosophy in all that he writes in all of Proverbs. That all of Proverbs is the basis for to have the physical world is wisdom. And those people that are lacking in wisdom, or they have wisdom, but they have certain emotions that affect their thinking process, at that point they're going to fail. And now suddenly he says, well, there's a protection. To say is we're using the fortified city as an allegory. So the thing is that when a person is in a protected city, even if he's not wise, that situation is a good situation. It's true in the long run he'll fail, but what King Solomon is saying, he's observing the physical world, and he's saying there are certain things, there are certain situations where having money is beneficial, where having certain protection is beneficial even without wisdom. It's true the wise person will be successful whether he has this or not, or work it out, you see. But practically in the physical world, there are, without wisdom, certain situations that are better than others. Like, for instance, if you have money, like you said before, practically, there are many things you can do. If your car breaks down, you don't have to worry. You just buy a new car, you just have to fix, you see.
that situation is a better situation than an unfortified city. You see? So therefore, the thing is that all he is saying is when you look around the world, you will see that there are situations which are better than others. That's all he's saying. That's a fact of life. But he's not saying that is better than wisdom. He's not saying money is better than wisdom. But he says money has a certain advantage. Having a fortified city has a certain advantage over an unfortified city. So the thing is that there are certain situations which, by definition, is just a better situation. But people have had very good situations and destroyed it because they didn't have the wisdom. They didn't know how to deal with it. You see? So therefore, his subject, what he's dealing with, is simply physical world without wisdom. That's it. There are situations which are better than others. That's all he says. To be rich and healthy than poor and sick. That's true. In general, is why is it that, like, one verse has nothing to do with the other verse, and he seems to be jumping from one subject to another subject, and one has nothing to do with the other? The answer is, in my opinion, is that this book was written for beginners. And the beginner it's very difficult to take a whole subject all at once. So therefore, that's why he made it into Proverbs. Proverbs is one sentence with all the information and one aspect of a very large subject. You see? It's a large subject, or this area could be worked out in a logical form. But he took the different verses, and each one is a different idea, so that the beginner can handle and deal with very simple ideas and very few facts, so that the beginner can develop his mind that way and start developing that way. Later on, he should take the whole subject of ethics. That would be like in the chapter of the Fathers, it's there, it's written categorically, you know, like you need. Doesn't go in this much detail as in Proverbs. If anything, Proverbs is written for the beginners, therefore the